time now for the interview portion of our program. As part of our four-part series on hacking through the ages, InfoSec Radio is pleased to bring you part one of a two-part interview with Chris Goggins, a.k.a. Eric Bloodaxe. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning, Dean.
Chris, how did it all start for you as a hacker?
It must have been, I was probably 10 years old. A friend of mine's father had gotten an Apple II to connect up to Dialog to research legal proceedings. And my friend wanted to show it out to me, so we called. We went over to his house, and he turned on the new computer and dialed up with an old Hayes Micromodem 2 pulse dial into a particular network dial-up. And we followed the instructions and logged on the Dialog, and we thought that was really cool. And in looking over the information about Dialog, we saw that you'd actually connect up to it through Telenet, which is now SprintNet, but it was Telenet back then. Connect up to it by entering in a five-digit network user address. And I said, well, gee, you know, why are we entering in 415 whatever? Why don't we enter in 214 whatever? Since, you know, we were in Dallas, let's see what there is in Dallas. So we changed a couple of digits and connected to something completely different. And I said, that's really cool. I wonder how many of these things there are. And it all sort of went off from there.
It seems in those days that a lot of people started out as freakers. Were you ever a freaker, or were you a freaker first and then a hacker, vice versa?
Well, it sort of all went together at the time. I mean, you have to realize, you know, if you're 10 years old and you're trying to call computer bulletin boards, unless you come from a particular kind of family, which I didn't, the long-distance phone bills that you'd incur trying to find bulletin boards to call would generally get you beat. And you know, we didn't have that kind of money. So in order to try to find ways to get there, you as an enterprising young child, you had to find ways to make sure mom didn't get that phone bill. And you know, that sort of led to things like long-distance services and things like blue boxes and stuff like that. So it all was sort of a natural progression because you had to have a way to make a phone call.
On the Phoenix board, on the Phoenix project, you had mentioned that you had spoken with Manuel Noriega.
No, never did that. We called Gaddafi once, posing as ABC News.
What was the end result of that call? How long did it last?
Not very, but we had a good laugh at it. Had several people set up, you know, saying, okay, all right, we've got you on the line, all right, and having other people pretend to be producers and stuff like that. Yeah, that was interesting. It was at the time when he was trying to gain a lot of, he was doing a lot of interviews to try to gain some sort of attention about something, so he was taking every call.
Did you ever talk to anybody else of any fame? I mean, it was pretty widely reported that you had a list of celebrities and other people's phone numbers.
It was widely reported? Well, that's interesting. No, actually, I didn't. We didn't really talk to that many people. I mean, in terms of, we used to set up teleconferences, we'd blue box up teleconferences. The people that we'd talk to would generally be, you know, we'd call random numbers in Australia just because we thought the accent was neat. Or, you know, we'd call up people who were working the late night shift at a switch room somewhere and add them in. Or we'd call up security people from different parts of the phone company or from different organizations and add them in. You know, that was about as much as the celebrity hunting went. I mean, you know, a guy in a switch room is a lot more entertaining than some actor.
What would you say was the first incident to really raise awareness with the federal authorities about hacking?
That's a good question. My guess is that the first thing to really raise awareness probably came from abuse of TRW credit systems back in the early 80s.
What was your favorite target when you were active?
There was really no favorite. I mean, it was just more or less looking for things that were diverse. You know, looking for things you hadn't seen before. And not so much in terms of information, but just in terms of operating systems. I mean, if you think back, I mean, we're talking 20 years ago here. If you think back of the kinds of operating systems that were around 20 years ago, I mean, there was such a diversity in the types of systems that you could find out there. I mean, now we're pretty homogenous. I mean, it's one or more flavors of Unix and one or more flavors of Microsoft products, and that's pretty much what everybody runs everywhere. You know, you go back 20 years ago, I mean, there are 20, 30 different types of operating systems. So the challenge for me was always finding something different that I'd never seen before and trying to figure out what it was and what it did.
You were first a member of and then the de facto leader of the Legion of Doom, or LOD. What brought you all together in the first place?
What started the group to begin with, there was a guy in South Florida called himself Lex Luthor. And, you know, there were a couple of groups around at the time. One of the biggest ones at the time was a thing that called themselves Knights of Shadow. They were pretty much a close-knit group of friends, mostly centered around upstate New York. Lex said, well, you know, I've got some other people that I think you ought to consider, you know, voting into this Knights of Shadow group, because they're really smart and they know a lot of stuff, and I think they'd be really good people to add in, and they're good friends of mine. And the people in Knights of Shadow said, no, we're not interested in any new members. This is pretty much just, you know, people that we're friends with, and, you know, we're not interested in taking any new members. And Lex thought that was a pretty stupid way to handle things. I said, okay, well, fine, I'll start my own group. And there was about a dozen or so people that he had talked to. I said, listen, I'm starting this new group, and if you're interested in being a member, we'd like to have you. And I was one of that first round of people.
After Operation Sun Devil, the Phoenix Project and other BBSs were basically shut down. After reopening the Phoenix Project, ostensibly to serve everyone, including the authorities and telcos, how much actual interaction was there between the hacking community on that board and those people in government and telco?
Oh, there was a lot, even from the beginning. I mean, associating Phoenix Project with Operation Sun Devil is sort of a misnomer. I mean, there were two separate investigations headed out from two separate jurisdictions. Phoenix Project was part of something different when that raid went down. It wasn't part of Sun Devil. But to answer your question, the whole point of Phoenix Project from its beginning, I mean, when Lloyd Blankenship set that board up, the whole point was for it to be an open forum where people could feel free to talk and discuss things, not necessarily anything specific about phone numbers or passwords or anything. The board was never like that. The board was about concepts and, you know, techniques or information about how operating systems worked, or to provide a forum where people could, you know, get to know one another. And there was a large number of people from a bunch of the different RBOX on there, and a bunch of different long distance companies, and people from both federal and state law enforcement bodies. I mean, that was the point of the board. And there was a good deal of interaction, and, you know, some of that interaction, I would imagine, with some of the relationships that were made, I mean, some of that interaction probably occurs from the same people even today.
In January of 90, FRAC was shut down by the University of Missouri because government agents had been monitoring email accounts of various FRAC people. Apparently, this was because a FRAC issue contained the E911 document. Speculation was that it had to be more than simply copyrighted information that was being published in FRAC. Can you tell us what really forced the Secret Service's hand in that whole investigation?
To the best of my knowledge, I think at the time, you have to realize, you know, 10 years ago, the level of awareness about computer-related crime in federal law enforcement was very small. They didn't understand it, and they were answering to a constituency of large companies that were scared. And so a lot of mistakes were made. And in the case of what happened with Craig Nydorf and FRAC, the Secret Service was given wrong information by the phone companies. You know, the phone company basically made up stuff as a guess as to how information like that must have been obtained, and the Secret Service acted on it. And as I think people were well aware, the ultimate outcome of that was the proof that the document that was in question was actually available from a public source by calling a 1-800 number and giving 1995 over a credit card. So, you know, the fact that had to have been obtained by some huge, you know, plot to take down the nation's phone networks was proven to just be hysteria, and all of that was just fanned along by the security officials within phone companies.
What was the Secret Service's focus of their investigation on you?
Relationship to you know, I had friends, my friends ran FRAC magazine. My friends were, you know, other members of the Legion of Doom who had contact with people with Brack. I mean, it was just sort of, it all stemmed out of that. You know, the initial thing came, and the whole thing started out in that particular investigation. There was a kid, I think he was probably 15 years old or something, who lived in Indiana, who had broken into some sort of credit card, either a credit verification service or into one of the credit bureaus, and was working on a way to try to send himself Western Union money with these stolen credit cards. And he got picked up. But because he was a minor, they said, well, you're a kid, but this is going to, you know, ruin your life, and you better work with us and this and that and the other. And so he gave over some names. He said, well, these are people I know, and they're a lot smarter than me. And he happened to name some people who were friends of mine in Atlanta. And an investigation started on that. And then from monitoring phone lines and listening in on and transcribing phone conversations, they built up a list of other names, including some guys in New York, and including some guys in Texas, and including some guys in Missouri. And all of this sort of came about based upon, you know, one kid who was actually trying to steal money, you know, who most of the people who were picked up in that particular raid that stemmed around Frack magazine, most of the people who were involved in that particular thing, you know, didn't even know this kid in Indiana. He just started naming names because, you know, he was probably scared.
Your postings on the Phoenix board during those 1990 raids were pretty vocal, and they seemed to represent somebody who was pretty darn afraid. When you look back on it now, do you think that you were perhaps some of your concerns were a bit misplaced?
No. I've said it a number of times. I mean, even though I was pretty young and brazen, you know, when you're young, you think you're bulletproof. When it all boils down to it, I mean, if you're doing something that's either inherently wrong or illegal, you know, you take a chance. And looking in the grand scheme of things, everybody was like me personally, I was just really lucky. But you know, at the time, you know, everybody expected the worst. You know, people were being picked up, and everybody really expected the worst. I mean, you know, looking back, it's easy to say, well, gee, you know, they made a lot of mistakes in investigations, and they made a lot of mistakes in this, and they just didn't understand the technology, and they didn't do. But that's sort of looking back. That sort of hindsight on the way investigations were carried out at the time. You know, that kind of hindsight, of course, it's easy to have now. But at the time, you know, who could have imagined that, you know, the people that were tasked with investigating computer-related crimes at the time were really that woefully ill-equipped to do the job? You know, so everybody expected the worst. And, you know, since then, a lot of the bodies that are involved in doing those kind of investigations have learned from mistakes that they made in the past. And, you know, I think probably most of the people who they were investigating learned from their mistakes of the past as well.
Was it a combination of the Morris Worm, the SRI people, and the Frack bust that began another, with all that together, is that what began the second round of bust, and did things really fall apart as much as it appears between 1989 and 1990 in the scene?
Probably the Morris Worm raised awareness of networks and interconnections that most people didn't even realize existed. The wave of raids that came about during, you know, I'd even stem it back from, you know, like the mid-80s to I guess like the very early 90s. A lot of that was just it was a knee-jerk reaction to an assumed threat. It's understandable. I mean, the companies were scared. Law enforcement didn't know what to do, so they did the best thing they could, and that was to go collect everybody they thought might know something and see what they could figure out. And it didn't lead to a lot of convictions, but it was probably a good learning experience for everybody involved.
At the time, most of the scene was contained on various BBSs across the country. How big an adjustment do you think it was for some people to move from the BBS system and closed networks to the Internet?
I don't think it was that big of an adjustment at all. You know, it lost a lot of the romance, but you know, it made it a lot easier. Cut down on a lot of phone bills, cut down on a lot of toll fraud, cut down on a lot of things, and it opened up it opened up those same bulletin boards to a much wider audience. I mean, if your whole point in, you know, at the time, if your whole social interaction took place through exchanged emails and teleconferences, you know, moving to the internet and moving onto things like internet relay chat or on forum or any of the other earlier chat systems, I mean, it just made it that much more immediate, made it that much more accessible, and in fact, that's, you know, the proliferation of the internet is what made it so that, you know, what was once a pretty small, closed, you know, a few hundred people around the world chatting with one another, it made it boom and made it accessible to where, you know, if you look on any of the computer hacker or so-called underground related chat channels on any of the IRC networks, I mean, you'll see thousands of people. So I think the adjustment was, you know, it was just taking advantage of new technology, and everybody adjusted to it well.
Do you think that with that explosion in growth, that affected the cohesiveness and the tightness and the sense of camaraderie in groups such as LOD?
Oh yeah, I mean, well, you know, when we decided that it was time to move on and sort of, you know, retired the group, as it were, you know, it had already reached kind of that point. Thinking back to, you know, the early 80s, I mean, there were about 20 or 30 people that seemed to frequent things nationally, you know, on bulletin boards who were on, like, the same bulletin boards around the United States or, you know, even when things started to pop up, like in Germany and Australia, there was only the same 20 or 30-some-odd Americans who could actually get there who were actually participating in things like that. And so it was very easy to say, oh, hey, you know, it's such and such, and you knew them. You may not have ever met them because I wasn't doing a lot of domestic traveling when I was 10, but you know, you knew these people. You knew them by voice, you knew them by skill, and you developed some respect for them. As any community grows away from sort of like that closed community of just a few people to thousands and thousands of nameless faces around the world, of course you're going to, I mean, things really do change. And in some ways it's changed for the better. Having a larger pool of people who are interested in security vulnerabilities and things like that mean that a lot more things are going to get discovered and fixed. But at the same time, having a larger community means that you're going to get people whose idea of right and wrong don't necessarily dovetail in with anybody else's. And there are people who think nothing about breaking into systems and destroying data or breaking into things for the sole purpose of you know, spray painting their name on them, or people who are looking to make a quick buck off of you know, trying to affect a particular company's stock price, or people who are looking for information to sell. When a community grows like that, you're going to have a lot of changes that are just unfortunately bound to happen. You know, if you would have gone on any of the chat systems that were used, you know, 20 years ago, specifically there were some like localized things that people would use at colleges, like Wharton School of Business had a chat program that ran on one of their PDPs that a lot of people used to hang out on. And everybody was really friendly with one another. Now, if you extrapolate that 20 years ahead to present day, well, now you've got, like, what, 10, 12 different IRC networks, each of them with their own set of people. If you go on any of the channels, you know, Pound Hack, Pound Frack, things like that, you'll see 100 people on there, the vast majority of them who probably you'll never know, you never want to know, and who wouldn't trust you with anything. They're not the kind of people you'd want to talk to. All of them in there sort of milling about. You're going to have a really weird cross-section of humanity. And that's just on those couple of channels. How many other channels are there? How many other people are there doing whatever? The proliferation of that kind of technology has enabled a lot of people to do a lot of really good things, but it's also enabled a lot of people who never would have had who never would have held any sort of, you know, I hate that hacker ethics sounds so trite, but who never would have abided by the same sort of self-policed rules that we gave ourselves 20 years ago, and that's unfortunate.
One of the things you're noted for is resurrecting, or giving credit for, rather, is resurrecting Frack when it needed it most after Night Lightning and Taron King had left. You had written in one of your posts that you'd rather start something a little better written, better formatted, with better articles under a different name. Whatever happened to Matrix?
at the time when we were considering doing something like that, you know, that thing actually came about when we were trying to compete with FRAC. That was during the time period that FRAC was still going strong, and, you know, I think I was in an argument or something with Craig Neidorf or something, so we decided to put out our own magazine. But when it boils down to it, I mean, you want to go for what has name recognition. You want to do something, you know, trying to keep some sort of consistency and some sort of ties back to the old days when everybody had sort of their innocence seemed important to me. And when FRAC in the 90s reached a point where it was either going to stop being published or someone could sort of take up the banner, you know, I said, okay, fine, I'll do that. You know, it just sort of made sense. I had time. I knew everybody who had been involved with it since its creation, and I said, okay, well, let's do this, but let's do it a little different. You know, and the first thing that I did was to get it an ISSN number, and the next thing I did was to try to sort of throw something in the face of people who, you know, always complained about hackers, you know, disregard for copyrights or anything like that. So I trademarked it and copyrighted the issues and said that, you know, that it was free for individual use, but had a commercial use fee. And as I watched people hit the FTP sites or try to join the mailing list from various companies or various law enforcement bodies, I sat and said, see, you know, they're not paying for this, and this is not for individual use there. So those are the kind of things that I wanted to do to further it. Plus, I wanted to have a section that would focus more on the community so that people could realize, you know, that they're really not alone, that people are exploring and uncovering and experiencing the same things that they're experiencing all around the world, and to try to put in more articles that were geared on not looking for articles that would really try to cause people damage. And, you know, I think I ran the thing for probably about 4 years until it reached a point in my life to where I just didn't have the free time anymore, and I handed it over to Mike Schiffman. You know, he's sort of taken it his own way. And, you know, that's a good thing as well. I mean, at least it's still there and it still continues to evolve. But, you know, having that thing that people can point to say, you know what, that thing's been around since way back when. To me, that just seems sort of important that something like that just continues to go on with the same sort of spirit that it was originally intended. You know, the format's changed, the article types have changed, and the slant has changed a little bit, but it still embodies the same spirit that it did when it was written by a couple of high school kids in St. Louis, Missouri.
Do you think that it still serves the community as well?
Yeah, but the community's changed. I mean, the same people who were reading FRAC when it went out over BitNet in the mid-80s are all people like myself now. These are people with real lives and real jobs and real families, and, you know, everybody's grown up. And the community at large is not just centered on 15-year-old kids looking for a cheap thrill. It's centered on people who have an interest and a desire to learn about technology, and that's expanded from that small base that it used to have. It's expanded to, you know, a wide range of people from, you know, high school to college to professional people, to people who have a passing interest in computing technology, to people who have made their careers in computers and computer security. So the audience has changed, but it's still people interested in the same thing. It's still people interested in that technology for technology's sake, and information about how things work and why things act the way they do.
There's a lot of hype surrounding the scene. One of the things that legends are made of course, in terms of the LOD, was a supposed war with MOD. In issue 36 of FRAC, MOD satirized you with a program synopsis. Was there really an MOD-LOD war, or was it more to do with the clash of personalities between yourself and Fiber Optic?
Well, I think it originally started with an argument that I had with Mark Abeny. And, you know, he had his friends, And he expressed his opinion about me to his friends, and I had my friends, and I expressed my opinion about him to my friends. And it just sort of goes from there. I mean, you don't, in any kind of group, whether it, you know, we could apply this if we were, well, let's pretend we're high school cheerleaders for a second. We're on one squad. Well, we don't like the people on the other one. And so, you know, you're going to sit there, you know, and it's almost as inane as that. I mean, we were basically a bunch of squabbling schoolgirls. I mean, it was just stupid. But, you know, looking back, I can see how certain enterprising authors might think that it'd make a good story. I mean, it certainly has a it certainly has a nice ring to it. You know, the gang war that tore apart cyberspace. I mean, but that's just, you know, that's just journalistic license, I suppose.
A lot of people have characterized MOD as being less concerned with ethics and more about doing damage. Conversely, LOD was characterized as being relatively responsible and holding some sort of hacker ethic, whatever that may be. Is that a fair characterization, or is that a bit overhyped?
Well, you know, I'd like to think that at least we tried to embody something. You know, there were certain rules that we had that if people looked like they were either straying away from what we considered to be acceptable behavior, we either got rid of them or you know, let them know exactly how we felt. MOD, I don't necessarily think really cared. A lot of it had, you know, a lot of the inner city street mentality sort of carried over into online relationships, and it was just sort of like, well, you know, I gotta, you know, get respect, and if anybody's gonna disrespect me, I gotta smack them down, and that's sort of how they carried out what they did.